So let's start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 15th of July, and we have a few colleagues to brief you on events which have been under the lights recently. We have all seen, I think, over the weekend, the tragic events that happened in Gaza, across Gaza, resulting in mass casualties, including among children. To talk about this, we have with us, and thanks for being with us, Julia Tuma, the Director of Communication of UNRWA from Amman, and we also have our colleague Tamin Al-Kitan from OHCHR, and we will hear from both of them, updates about the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory. I'll start with Juliette. Juliette, welcome. Thanks for being with us. You have the floor. Thanks.
Thanks, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. Like Alessandra said, I will give an update on the occupied Palestinian territory, and I also speak to the work of UNRWA that we continue to do through our teams on the ground in the OPT. And then I'll end up with a couple of announcements. So on the Gaza Strip this morning, I will focus on latest data that we got from our clinics, our medical points in the Gaza Strip, specifically on malnutrition on children, among children. Like I said, this is based on latest findings. Our doctors, our nurses, our health teams are confirming that malnutrition rates are increasing in Gaza, especially since the siege was tightened more than 4 months ago on the 2nd of March. So we've seen in our clinics an increase in malnutrition among children. Since January 2024, so over a course of a year and a half, the UNRWA health teams screened in the clinics and medical points of UNRWA across the Gaza Strip more than 240,000 boys and girls under the age of five. So the age range is from 6 months to 5 months old. Currently, one in 10 children screened in those clinics and UNRWA facilities is malnourished, one in 10 children. Before the war, acute malnutrition was rarely seen in the Gaza Strip. One UNRWA nurse that we spoke to told us that in the past, he only saw these cases of malnutrition in textbooks and documentaries. Today, he's treating them face-to-face in the UNRWA health centers. The growing number of children in need of therapeutic treatment risks overwhelming the already devastated health system in the Gaza Strip. I'll tell you the story of Ahlam. She is a baby girl that our teams in Gaza have been treating, and they told us her story. She's only 8 months old. On average, since the war started on the 7th of October, her family, Ahlam's family, was displaced almost once a week. She now lives in a tent with five other family members with not much food available for Ahlam. She is severely malnourished despite the care that she is getting from the UNRWA health teams. Her condition keeps getting worse by the day. Like many other babies in Gaza, her immune system has been damaged by trauma, constant forced displacement, lack of clean water, poor hygiene, and very, very little food. There's very little therapeutic supplies to help children with malnutrition in Gaza. Medicines, nutritional supplies, hygiene material, fuel are all rapidly running out. UNRWA also ran out of food, if you recall, at the end of April this year. UNRWA continues to be the largest humanitarian organization in Gaza. The agency, however, has been banned from bringing any humanitarian aid to Gaza, including nutrition supplies to treat babies like Ahlam, for more than 4 months now since the 2nd of March. As of this morning, UNRWA ran out of nearly 60% of essential medicines. As an example, we no longer have medicines to treat patients with hypertension, and the agency's clinics ran out of antibiotics for adults. As malnutrition among children spreads across the war-torn enclave, UNRWA has over 6,000 trucks of food, hygiene supplies, medicine, medical supplies outside of Gaza. They're all waiting to go in. During the ceasefire between January and March, mid-January to mid-March earlier in the year, the United Nations, including UNRWA, were providing at scale and dignified assistance to people. We managed through that work to reverse the trend and the deepening hunger, including among children. This functioning system was replaced with one that takes more lives than it saves. While there is a lot of focus out there, you might see on social media and in the media on food being distributed, the people of Gaza need more than just food. Above all, they need safety. But no place is safe in Gaza, and no one has been spared. The people of Gaza also need medicine. They need hygiene supplies like soap. They need water, sanitary pads for women and girls, diapers for babies and older people. And they need nutrition supplies for babies like Ahlam. It is more than just food, let alone feeding people. The UN, including UNRWA, must be allowed to do our work, also for the sake of children across the Gaza Strip. I'll say a few words, Alessandra, on the situation in the West Bank, and then I'll say a few words about the work of UNRWA. So on the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, we continue to have a silent war that is surging, where heavy restrictions on movement continue, where poverty is increasing as people are cut off from their livelihoods and unemployment soars. And it's great to have Thamin online because he'll give a much more detailed briefing on the West Bank. The impact of the ongoing military operations by Israeli forces and the violence by Israeli settlers, they're forcing more people to be displaced. According to our UNRWA colleagues, this ongoing operation has been the longest since the 2000s during the Second Intifada. This is mainly in the northern West Bank. It is impacting several refugee camps in the area, and it is causing the largest population displacement of the Palestinians in the West Bank since 1967. Just a few words on the work of UNRWA, and to confirm and emphasize and ask the media to help us to continue to say that UNRWA continues despite all these challenges, despite a very, very challenging financial situation and a crisis that the agency is going through, despite all the hurdles that I've mentioned to you across the occupied Palestinian territory. Our teams continue to work. We have a staff of about 14,000 people across the OPT who continue to deliver services and assistance, not only to Palestine refugees, but to people in need, especially in the Gaza Strip. And I'll give you a few examples. On average, every day, despite everything in the Gaza Strip, our medical teams, our health teams, continue to give 15,000 consultations a day in the UNRWA clinics, in the medical points across the Gaza Strip. In total, since the war began, the health teams at UNRWA gave over 9 million health consultations. Only this year alone, we've provided domestic water and drinking water to 1.3 million people in the Gaza Strip. That's about 60% of the population. Our teams continue to manage shelters for displaced people with more and more forced displacement orders from the Israeli authorities. More people are forced to flee, and they often come to UNRWA shelters, which the agency continues to manage. We've reached, last but not least, and very important, we've reached more than 500,000 boys and girls with psychological support across the Gaza Strip. In the West Bank, the school year has just finished a couple of weeks ago, and we were able to continue to provide education until the end of the school year to about 40,000 boys and girls who went to UNRWA schools in the West Bank. And hundreds of thousands of people continue to go to UNRWA clinics in the area. And like I said, in the northern West Bank, because of the displacement, there are humanitarian needs of people who are being forced to flee, and UNRWA provides them with relief and basic assistance. In closing, just to say that we have a few resources that I will share, Alessandra, with you, that we've updated a couple of documents on our website that I'd like to bring to the attention of the media, the claims versus facts about UNRWA. That's been updated, made available on the website. We've published last night a blog on nutrition and the children of Gaza that can be republished in media outlets, and I'll send that. And we also have quite a lot of multimedia material, so photos and raw footage in B-roll, and also videos on the nutrition of children in the Gaza Strip. Thank you, Alessandra.
Thank you very much, Juliette, for this update. Yes, and please share the documents. We will make them available to the journalists here. I see hands already up, but please, before we do that, I'd like to listen to Tamin, that as Juliette also noted, the he's going to tell us more about the West Bank and killing and forced displacement of Palestinians by Israeli forces. Tamin.
Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you, Juliette, for the briefing, and good morning, everyone. Israeli settlers and security forces have intensified killings, attacks, and harassment of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, in the past weeks. This includes the demolition of hundreds of homes and forced mass displacement of Palestinians, contributing to the ongoing consolidation of annexation of West Bank territory by Israel in violation of international law. Since the launch of Israel's Operation Iron Wall in the north of the West Bank earlier this year, about 30,000 Palestinians remain forcibly displaced. Israeli forces have shot live ammunition at unarmed Palestinians, including those attempting to go back to their homes in the refugee camps of Jenin, Tul Karim, and Nur Shams. Israeli security forces have often used unnecessary or disproportionate force, including lethal force, against Palestinians who did not pose an imminent threat to life. The youngest victim, 2-year-old Leila Al-Khatib, was shot dead in the head by Israeli security forces on the 25th of January while she was inside her house in Ashuhada village. On the 3rd of July, 61-year-old Walid Bdir was shot and killed by the Israeli security forces, reportedly while he was cycling back home from prayers, passing through the outskirts of the Nur Shams camp. Leila and Walid are among at least 964 Palestinians killed since the 7th of October 2023 by Israeli forces and settlers in occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Also, since the 7th of October 2023, 53 Israelis have been killed in reported attacks by Palestinians or in armed clashes, 35 in the West Bank and 18 in Israel. In June, the UN recorded the highest monthly injury toll of Palestinians in over two decades. In all, 96 Palestinians were injured by Israeli settlers. During the first half of 2025, there have been 757 settler attacks that resulted in Palestinian casualties or property damage, a 13% increase on the same period in 2024. Since the start of Operation Iron Wall, Israeli security forces have issued demolition orders for about 1,400 homes in the north of the occupied West Bank. These large-scale demolitions, if not rendered absolutely necessary by military operations, violate Israel's obligations as the occupying power. In addition, Israeli demolitions have displaced 2,907 Palestinians across the West Bank since the 7th of October 2023. In the same period, a further 2,400 Palestinians, nearly half of them children, have been forcibly displaced as a result of the actions of Israeli settlers, thus emptying large parts of the West Bank of Palestinians. Permanently displacing the civilian population within occupied territory amounts to unlawful transfer, a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, and depending on the circumstances, may also amount to a crime against humanity. Israel must immediately stop these killings, harassment, and home demolitions across the occupied Palestinian territory. As the occupying power, Israel must take all feasible measures to ensure public order and safety in the West Bank. It is under the obligation to protect Palestinians from settler attacks and to end the unlawful use of force by its security forces. There must be thorough, independent, and transparent investigations into all the killings and all other alleged violations of international law. Those found responsible must be held to account. In line with the advisory opinion issued by the International Court of Justice, Israel must end its unlawful presence in the occupied Palestinian territory. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin, and thanks again to Juliette. And I also would like to call your attention to what the Secretary General said yesterday at the end of the press conference where he was launching the SDG report when he spoke about Gaza, when he said we absolutely need a permanent ceasefire in Gaza. And I hope that the parties will be able to overcome the difficulties that they still find for that ceasefire to take place. But the ceasefire is not enough. It is essential that ceasefire leads to a solution, and that solution can only be possible if both Palestinian and Israeli can have a state where they can exercise their right. And he referred to the conference on the two-state solution that should happen in New York on 28th and 29th of July. I'll open the floor to questions. Lots of questions. I saw first Nina, and then Christian, and then Olivia.
Yeah, thanks for these briefings. I had a couple of questions on Gaza. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about the Israeli announced plans for the, humanitarian city is what they're calling it. If you could say what that would mean in terms of human rights law to forcibly displace the entire Palestinian population in Gaza into that area. When it comes to the West Bank, as you were talking about June having the most injuries, I think, in a very long time, was that only injuries from settlers, or was it also from Israeli military? And could you break down those numbers? And just on the West Bank in general, if you could say, I mean, it sounds like there's also this sort of mass displacement there. Are you worried that the West Bank is going to resemble sort of what's we've already seen in Gaza? Thank you.
I guess these are more for you, Tamin.
Thank you for these questions, Nina. I'll try to answer all of them now. On the figures, so 96 Palestinians were injured by Israeli settlers. This concerns attacks by settlers. And the increase that I've mentioned, it's also about settler attacks in the West Bank. Concerning forced displacement, of course, this is a huge concern for us, and we are seeing already Palestinians who are being forcibly displaced inside the West Bank. We should recall that international law is very clear about this in terms of the obligations of the occupying power. Bringing about permanent demographic change inside the occupied territory may amount to a war crime and is tantamount to ethnic cleansing. So these are obligations for the occupying power to not make any changes to the demographic to the demographics of the occupied territory. In Gaza, we have seen these reports about establishing a so-called humanitarian city in Rafah. And there are also calls for voluntary movement of Palestinians in Gaza to third countries. In all, these calls raise concerns of forcible transfer. First of all, the setting up of such a humanitarian city in itself is problematic, and it raises concerns about further forced displacement. Of course, without proper humanitarian assistance. And it is likely that men and women of certain age groups could be at higher risk of arbitrary detention. We have concerns of disappearances, family separation, of course, the lack of freedom of movement, and you know the whole situation of thousands of people being crammed into a small area in the Gaza Strip. This is very much concerning, and it would add more difficulties in terms of aid distribution. And also, of course, we cannot talk about any voluntary movement of people from Gaza to third countries, because for the movement to be voluntary, we should give the people the choice in terms of life conditions to remain in Gaza. And then we can talk about whether they can have the choice or not. Thank you.
Juliette, if you want to add anything. Yeah, I saw you were nodding before. Go ahead.
Sure. Hi, Nina. Great to see you. Look, on the question on the quote-unquote humanitarian city with very big quote-unquote, the Commissioner General of UNRWA just a few days ago issued a statement on that. I don't know if you've seen it, Nina, but he said that this would be de facto creating a massive concentration camp at the border with Egypt. If it helps, I can send you the link to the statement, Nina, and everyone. And also to say that as we've seen at the beginning of the war, when there were all these announcements and plans for humanitarian zones, we reminded everyone in the UN that these unilateral decisions are contradictory to international humanitarian law, and they cannot be done without the agreement of all parties to the conflict. So that's also something that we can refer to when it comes to these statements about this so-called city.
Thank you, Juliette. Yeah, if you can add the link to the package that you're sending so that we can send it to the journalists. I saw you put some many things in the chat, but we can also send it by email to the journalists who are not connected. Sorry, Christian? Yeah, that's right. So it's better that we send it to everyone by email. Christian, you had a question. Christian DPA?
Yes, thank you. Good to see you, Juliette. My question is on the very first figures that you mentioned on malnutrition. Just to clarify, you said 1 in 10 children between 6 months and 5 years is malnourished. What is the total number of these children malnourished at this point? Because you also mentioned that 240 boys and girls have been screened over the last year and a half, but they might have been diagnosed as malnutrition, malnourished. Malnourished, sorry, as malnourished which has then changed in the course of the 18 months or so. So my question is, how many are malnourished at this point in time?
Yeah, thanks very much. This is a great question. So this data that I shared this morning, Christiane and everyone, is only for the children, the babies who came to UNRWA clinics and medical points. There's other screenings happening against malnutrition in other health facilities. But this data that I shared this morning is only about the UNRWA clinics and medical points. Over 240,000 children screened, all of them under the age of five, all of them since January 2024. And of those, one in 10 is malnourished currently. And we've seen an increase in cases, in babies coming to clinics with malnutrition, especially since March. And there is a correlation between the siege, blocking the entry of food and also nutrition supplies to help babies since the siege was put in place. That was more than 4 months ago.
So, and maybe, Christiane, I don't know if it can help, but yesterday we got these numbers from UNICEF that said that last month, so that was last month, more than 5,800 children were diagnosed with malnutrition in Gaza, including more than 1,000 children with severe acute malnutrition. This is an increase for the fourth month in a row. But you can ask, James is not available, but I'm sure that UNICEF can still answer your question. You have another follow-up?
No, I just wanted a clarification. So if a child was diagnosed as malnourished in January 2024, that doesn't mean that it is malnourished today, because it might have, in the meantime, when aid came in, it might have recovered. So I wonder whether you can say that out of the 240,000 that have been screened since January 2024, they were diagnosed at one point in time, but it doesn't mean they are malnourished today.
Yes. And we have seen an increase in the malnutrition rates among children, especially since March. And you know, Christiane, what's really alarming is the cases are severe acute malnutrition, what we call SAM. And that is the alarming part. And that we've seen over the course of the past months, including in UNRWA clinics, babies dying of malnutrition, including most recently a girl that I speak about in my blog that I shared with Alessandra. Her name was Salam, 7 months old. By the time she reached the clinic at UNRWA, it was too late and she died.
Awful.
All of this to say is what really needs to happen. Sorry, Alessandra, if I may. What really needs to happen is a ceasefire, is a deal, and is a standard flow of humanitarian supplies. It's not just about food. It's not just about dry food. It's also about these supplement for children. It's about therapeutic supplies with children with malnutrition. And the longer time goes on, the clock ticks faster and faster towards more children dying of starvation or suffering of malnutrition in Gaza, which is, like I said in the briefing, is not something that we've had in Gaza before the war.
Absolutely. Olivia, Reuters.
Thank you both for the briefing, and thank you to my colleagues who've asked questions I was seeking answers to, so that's great. But just one question from me for Juliet. The European Union struck a deal last week with Israel to allow more aid into the enclave. Have you seen any material differences on the ground since that deal was struck?
Thanks, Olivia, and really good to see you. Like I said, for UNRWA, there's no change. And for the people that UNRWA serves, there is no change. We've been banned from bringing in any humanitarian assistance into Gaza for more than 4 months now. We have 6,000 trucks waiting in places like Egypt, like Jordan. It's from Jordan to the Gaza Strip. It's a 3-hour drive, right? The trucks are loaded with humanitarian supplies, including food, but also hygiene supplies like bars of soap, as a very simple example, like medicine. Medicine and food are going to soon expire if we're not able to get those supplies to people in Gaza who need it most, among them 1 million children, who are half the population of the Gaza Strip.
Thank you. Tu veux une question? Oui.
Merci beaucoup. C'est Moussa Al-Mayadine. J'ai une petite question pour Juliette. Donc, vous avez parlé que l'UNRWA continue à travailler quoi qu'il se passe. Et vous avez parlé aussi qu'il n'y a plus rien qui entre à Gaza. Je me demande, donc, votre réserve à Gaza en termes de nourriture médicale et autres, il suffit combien de temps? Et la capacité de distribuer ça aux gens, comment ça se passe? Et j'ai d'autres questions pour Tamim, peut-être après. Non, j'ai deux, trois questions à Tamim, donc je préfère...
Julia,
Alessandro, do you want me to take this? Yeah, thank you, Moussa. I'll respond in English. The reserves, look, like I said, we're at 60% when it comes to the medicines, and we've run out of certain amounts of, types of medicines, like antibiotics for adults, like medicine for hypertension. For the therapeutic supplies for children, we rely very, very heavily on UNICEF. And they are the ones who have been very generous in giving us the therapeutic supplies, you know, Plumpidos and those other treatments that we give for malnourished kids. And so it really depends on how much they themselves are able to bring into Gaza. So I prefer you ask that specific question to UNICEF, Moussa. Alessandra, back to you.
Thank you very much. Moussa, the questions are also on the OPT. OK, alors demandez à Tamim et puis je passe à la plateforme. Allez-y.
Oui. Alors, merci. D'abord, la démission de membres de commission d'enquête dans les territoires occupés. Il paraît que vous avez reçu, ou bien donc la commission a reçu la démission. J'aimerais bien savoir un peu plus de détails, les raisons pour cette démission générale. Et j'ai une deuxième question concernant notre collègue Nasser Al-Laham à Ramallah. Donc les forces israéliennes ont pénétré dans notre bureau. Ils ont tout cassé, tout détruit et voler ce qui reste. Et notre chef de bureau, Nasser, est emprisonné depuis 9 jours. Je ne sais pas si vous avez des informations là-dessus. Et concernant votre statement, est-ce que, comme vous dites, donc, les forces israéliennes ont souvent eu recours à une force disproportionnée? En face, on avait des civils. Donc, les Israéliens, les forces israéliennes attaquent qui exactement? Des civils, des gens armés, des groupes armés ou quoi exactement? Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Moussa, pour toutes ces questions. Concernant la démission des membres de la commission d'enquête, vous savez, la commission est complètement indépendante. Nous avons reçu l'information comme vous. Nous sommes au courant de cette démission. Mais je pense que le mieux, c'est de poser la question au Conseil des droits de l'homme directement et à la commission directement.
Oui, juste sur ça, Moussa, Pascal, s'il ne pouvait pas venir ce matin, mais il nous a dit que s'il y avait des questions sur ça, vous pouvez les contacter directement. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. Et concernant donc le cas de du journaliste Nasser Al-Laham, nous avons aussi vu les rapports ce matin qui disent qu'il avait été déjà libéré sans condition. Comme je vous ai dit la semaine dernière, nous avons suivi son cas. Nous n'avons pas toutes les informations le concernant. Nous savons qu'il avait été accusé de terrorisme, mais nous savons aussi que c'est En général, c'est une tendance pour les autorités israéliennes d'accuser des journalistes, d'envoyer des accusations de terrorisme et d'incitation contre des journalistes. Et ce sont des mesures parfois qui peuvent être destinées à silencier les journalistes, silencier la critique envers les politiques des autorités israéliennes. Tous les journalistes doivent être libres de faire leur travail. Concernant le cas de Nasser al-Ham, nous suivons encore toujours la situation et dès qu'on a plus d'informations, on peut les partager, bien sûr. Vous aviez une troisième question, oui, sur la nature. Est-ce qu'on parle de civil ou de militaire? D'abord, ce qui s'applique dans le territoire de la Cisjordanie occupée, c'est le droit international relatif aux droits humains. Donc ce n'est pas le droit international humanitaire dans le cadre de des opérations des forces de l'ordre. Est-ce que ces gens-là qui ont été tués étaient armés? Peut-être qu'il y en a qui étaient armés. On ne peut pas tout savoir. Mais ce qui est sûr, c'est qu'il y a un certain nombre de personnes qui ont été tuées, qui n'ont pas été armées, qui n'étaient pas armés, qui ne posaient aucun risque pour la vie des forces de l'ordre israéliennes. Je veux dire, prenez l'exemple de la petite Leïla, 2 ans, qui a été abattue chez elle, une balle dans la tête. Est-ce qu'elle posait un risque pour les forces israéliennes? J'ai d'autres exemples aussi devant moi. Le cas que j'ai mentionné du monsieur Walid Bder, qui avait 61 ans, qui était en train de rentrer chez lui à vélo. Je peux vous citer d'autres cas aussi qui sont clairement des cas de personnes qui n'ont pas été en situation de poser un risque pour la vie des forces israéliennes. Donc, ces meurtres doivent cesser tout de suite et il doit y avoir des enquêtes. Et c'est pour ça qu'on réclame des enquêtes, pour justement avoir la vérité sur tous ces cas-là. Est-ce qu'ils étaient armés ou pas? Pour certains, comme je vous l'ai dit, il est clair qu'ils n'étaient pas armés.
Parce que j'ai un petit problème avec le terme utilisé, disproportionné. À ma compréhension, quand on utilise ces termes, ça veut dire qu'il y a un risque. On a répondu d'une façon exagérée. Mais là, les cas que vous avez mentionnés, il n'y a pas de risque du tout avec une fillette de 2 ans ou les autres. Donc, j'ai un problème avec l'utilisation de ces termes. Pourquoi vous utilisez disproportionné dans ces genres de situations?
Parce que, vous savez, dans le droit international, en tant que force d'occupation, les forces de sécurité israéliennes peuvent parfois avoir des opérations de maintien de l'ordre. Surtout en Cisjordanie, où il n'y a pas de conflit actif, les opérations doivent être celles de maintien de l'ordre et non pas des opérations militaires. Dans le maintien de l'ordre, il peut y avoir un usage de force, et vous le voyez dans tous les pays, mais cet usage de force, on l'a remarqué, dans beaucoup de cas, était disproportionné.
Merci beaucoup. Imogen.
Hello, thank you. Thank you for taking my question. It's for UN Human Rights, but I don't know whether perhaps Juliette wants to come in as well. Now, last week, on Friday, UN Human Rights gave us figures about people being killed trying to get aid in Gaza. Almost 800, more than 600 of them, you said, close to these GHF aid distribution points. Since then, I mean, I was in touch with GHF over the weekend. They are quite adamant, basically, that this is not true. And they say that the UN is hurling insults and basing its information on propaganda from terrorist groups. I think I probably speak for all of the journalists here that there is this issue of Hamas and the attack on Israel, and then people who work in Gaza for the public sector, and the or for the health service, for example. And I'm just wondering, what is your response when consistently every single day I've had a statement from GHF since last week suggesting to you and Human Rights that you are at best repeating lies?
Maybe it's Tavin and then also Juliet, if you want to add anything.
Yes, thank you, Imogen, for that. First of all, I do have updates on these figures. As of the 13th of July, we have recorded 875 people killed in Gaza while trying to get food. 674 of them were killed in the vicinity of GHF sites. Now, the data we have is based on our own information gathering through various reliable sources, including medical, human rights, and humanitarian organizations. It is still, of course, being verified in accordance with the strict methodology of the UN Human Rights Office. So the health authorities, first of all, for these figures, the health authorities in Gaza are not the only source of our information. As you know, we have said that repeatedly from our past experience with the Ministry of Health in Gaza in past conflicts. We can say that the figures that they have provided turned out to be close to the figures that we have managed to verify later. And as you know, we don't have complete access, and the process of verification at our office, according to our strict methodology, is ongoing and can take some time. So we repeat again that there need to be investigations in each and every killing in order to establish the facts and for those responsible to be held to account. Thank you.
Juliet.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Imogen, and thanks, Samin. Look at our teams on the ground, UNRWA teams and other United Nations teams have spoken to survivors of these killings, starving children included, who were shot at while on their way to pick up very little food. James Elder himself spoke to several of those survivors. One kid, if you recall, had died. And I second the OHCHR call for investigations into all of these killings and all other violations, including against UNRWA. So far, we are nearing 330 UNRWA staff killed, as one example. And 80% of our schools have been hit, as another example. So there's constant violations that must be investigated. And then there is this, again, we're in this loophole of he said, she said, he's lying, she's lying, disinformation, misinformation, yes, no. And international media continues to be banned from going into Gaza. And until international media is allowed to go into Gaza to report firsthand on what's happening to Gaza and the people of Gaza in Gaza, we are going to continue to be stuck in claims versus facts. And so it's an urge again for international media to be finally allowed to go into Gaza. Also to support the great work that local Palestinian journalists have been doing in telling the story of the atrocities in the Gaza Strip.
Indeed. Satoko, Yumiuri Shimbun.
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. I have a question to Juliet about UNRWA school. About 2 months ago, you told us that the armed Israeli forces invaded UNRWA school in East Jerusalem. So could you give us an update on the 6th UNRWA school in East Jerusalem and what happened to the about the 800 boys and girls since then. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. We were forced to close the schools, and the Israeli authorities came to the schools. At the beginning, they gave a stop work or closure orders for these schools. There were a couple of incidents when force was used, including tear gas. The schools were eventually closed just a few weeks before the end of the school year. So at some point towards end of May, and absolutely right that there were 600 boys and girls who were forced to continue their schooling through alternative learning, meaning they couldn't physically go to school anymore. We don't know the fate of these schools at the beginning of the year after the summer holidays. We call once again for these schools to be reopened. These are United Nations schools, and so they are protected by international law.
Thank you, John. France 24 and Lancet.
Yes, good morning. My question is to Juliet. Following up on Christian's question, Juliet, if you could repeat the numbers of children suffering from malnutrition, and in particular, those suffering from severe acute malnutrition, and if you have any information, if UNRWA still has health centers that are doing screenings for malnutrition, or is that dependent on other facilities to do that, and voluntary organizations, et cetera. Thanks very much.
Juliet has just sent us the numbers, and yes. Solange has distributed. Mm-hmm. You have them in. You have her notes in your email box.
Let me though clarify, sure. John. Thank you very much for the question. The data that I've given this morning is all from UNRWA clinics and health facilities. Like I said, there are other entities in the Gaza Strip who are going, who are doing screening of children against malnutrition. But the data that I shared this morning, which, like Alessandra said, is in the briefing note, that's from only UNRWA facilities and clinics. We still have a few clinics that are still standing and still functioning. But what we've also done, John, is we've created these temporary medical points, whether they are mobile or they're fixed, for example, in places like shelters. And this is where we have about 1,000 health staff at UNRWA that continue to work providing health services, including screening of children against malnutrition. Now, since January 2024, so a year and a half, in those UNRWA facilities, medical facilities, we have screened over 240,000 children against malnutrition. 10% of those children screened, or 1 in 10, have been diagnosed with malnutrition. We do have a breakdown of how many are SAM and how many are MAM and how many are GAM, but I'm not going to go into details here. What I suggest we do, John, is you email me after the briefing and I'll put you in touch with our director of health, who can walk you through exactly what we're seeing in our clinics and explain to you also medically the increases. And again, I think what's really key here, John, is that we are seeing a significant increase in the number of children diagnosed with malnutrition since March. So there is a correlation between not allowing food and other supplies into Gaza and an increase in malnutrition among children.
Thanks. I was going to say last question from Nick. Okay, Nick and Olivia. Nick Kamimbrous, New York Times.
Yeah, good morning. Nice to see you, Juliet. A question to you and to Tamin. Juliet, you said that the displacement in the West Bank was now the highest level since 1967. And Tamin, you mentioned a figure of 30,000 since the start of Operation Wall and Wall. I just wanted to check, are you talking about the same thing? Is this the highest level of displacement under this particular operation? And what is the current total population displaced in the West Bank at this point? And are you seeing an acceleration in the levels of attacks, would you say, and displacement in recent weeks and What do you think is the dynamic that's driving that at this point? Thank you.
Juliet, you want to start, and then Thamin?
Oh, sure. Let me have a stab, and then Thamin has a lot of information. Well, a couple of things, Nick. Very, very good to hear you. Look, there is this ongoing operation that has been happening in the north of the West Bank and impacting largely Palestinian refugee camps in the area. We're talking about three camps that have been impacted in particular. That's Jenin camp, Tul Karim camp, and Nur Shams camp. And according to the data from our teams, which tallies with what Thamin has shared with us this morning, is about, yes, over 30,000 people who have been forced to flee their homes, including from these camps. At some point during this operation, Jenin camp was, as an example, was totally emptied, right? And so there is an increase in violence, and with that comes a displacement, which, according to the data, is the highest since the war of 1967 in the West Bank, in particular, we're talking. Our international teams have been banned from going into the occupied West Bank. The Israeli authorities have stopped giving us visas to go to the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. That's since January this year. So it's been almost exactly 6 months now. And the same applies for Gaza. So monitoring human rights violations and monitoring the impact of the displacement on the humanitarian impact of this operation is very challenging. We do, however, have our, like I said, local staff who help, but it's not as it used to be, especially in terms of how robust it used to be when we had international presence across the West Bank.
Yes, thank you, Nick. So as Juliet said, from this operation, Iron Wall, in these three camps in the northern occupied West Bank, there are about 30,000 Palestinians who remain forcibly displaced. The Israeli security forces have issued demolition orders for about 1,400 homes in these camps. In addition to that, Israeli demolitions have displaced 2,907 Palestinians across the West Bank since the 7th of October 2023. These are mainly justified by lack of construction permits, which are almost impossible for Palestinians to obtain. In the same period, a further 2,400 Palestinians, nearly half of them children, have been forcibly displaced as a result of actions by Israeli settlers. So, of course, yeah, these figures are alarming, and Israel, as the occupying power, has the obligation to refrain from permanently displacing the population living under its occupation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll take a last question from Olivia, and then we will go to Ukraine.
Thank you. This is just a quick clarification, Thamin. Thank you. You said it's 875 deaths recorded, right, in the vicinity of aid points. And I just wanted to check if that also, you said it's near kind of aid points, including GHF, but does that also mean other relief groups, including the UN, like convoys run by the UN? And just secondly, just want to check that it is 674 of those which were in the vicinity of GHF. Thank you.
Yes, so 875 people killed while trying to get food, 674 of them killed in the vicinity of the GHF sites, and the remaining 201 killed on the routes of aid convoys or near aid convoys. These aid convoys can be by the UN or other humanitarian organizations. But as you know, there are very few of them in the Gaza Strip, unfortunately.
Thank you very much to both our speakers and the journalists for their questions. I see that Solange has sent another message with all the information that came from Juliet. Juliet, thank you so much for being with us this morning to update the Geneva Press Corps. Continue doing so, please, as this dire and terrible situation continues to unfold. Thank you very much, but you're not leaving me alone because I've got your colleague on the podium with me, Liz, to speak about the other big story of the weekend and of the last years, which is Ukraine. And with Liz, we also have WHO. Tariq has brought us Dr. Jarno Habic, who, as you know, is WHO representative and head of country office in Ukraine from Kyiv. So thank you very much again for the briefing on Gaza, and let's move to Ukraine. I'll start with Liz, and then we will go to Jarno. Liz.
Yes, good morning, everyone. You'll have seen that we have actually issued our Ukraine briefing note. I will highlight some points that we make in it. According to our latest information, so far this month, at least 139 civilians have reportedly been killed and 791 injured in Ukraine amid intense and successive waves of missile and drone strikes launched by the Russian Federation. In an overnight attack on the 12th of July, Russian armed forces reportedly deployed 597 Shahed loitering munitions and decoy drones and 26 missiles. Two civilians were killed and 41 reportedly injured. Damage to civilian infrastructure was reported across several regions, including Chernivtsi, Lviv, Cherkasy, Volyn, and Kirovohrad, far away from the front lines. On the 9th of July alone, Russian armed forces launched a record number of long-range drones against Ukraine, 728. July has brought no respite for civilians in Ukraine after June, which, according to our monitoring, saw the highest monthly number of civilian deaths and injuries in 3 years. In fact, since May 2022, there were 232 people killed and 1,343 injured. The devastating physical and psychological impact on civilians of repeated attacks in this and other conflicts cannot be captured by numbers alone. People are having to spend hours sheltering, including in basements, corridors, and available refuges such as metro stations. Children, older people, and people with disabilities are especially vulnerable to the prolonged stress and disruption of sleep, and in some cases, they're unable to get to shelter. Intense and sustained attacks using explosive weapons with wide area effects in populated areas are likely to have indiscriminate impacts and as such raise serious concerns as to their compliance with international humanitarian law. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, reiterates that an immediate ceasefire is needed now to end this unbearable suffering. The Russian Federation's full-scale armed attack on Ukraine must urgently be halted, and work on a lasting peace in line with international law must intensify. A peace that ensures accountability for gross violations of international human rights law and serious violations of international humanitarian law. The High Commissioner also highlights that it is vital that any negotiations focus on a coordinated push as immediate steps to end attacks that affect civilians, to protect the rights of people in occupied territory, return forcibly transferred or deported children, establish humanitarian corridors across the line of control, and end the torture and ill treatment of prisoners of war and other detainees. He urges the Russian Federation and Ukraine to commit to a full exchange of prisoners of war. Resolving the fate of civilian detainees also needs to remain high on the agenda. I'll leave it there, but there are some more details in our briefing note regarding our work interviewing released prisoners of war. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. And as you said, the notes are in your email boxes. And I'll go now to Jarno Habic. Jarno, it's nice to see you again. Please, go ahead with your... introductory remarks.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks for having Ukraine in the agenda and also Liz to describe the situation that many Ukrainians, but also the humanitarian workers, international organizations, everybody who is in Ukraine is going through and feeling daily. What we see is that civilian casualties almost doubled in quarter two if we compare it to quarter one. So the situation at the time of peace talks is getting more grim for the civilians. But also, while we all met in Ukraine Recovery Conference, trying to keep the optimism looking to the future, WHO also reached to monitor, verify, and report 2,500 attacks on health last Thursday. So while many partners came together in Ukraine Recovery Conference and the health sector got pledges for $200 million worth of projects and initiatives, the attacks and suffering continues. And the whole recovery needs more than $19.4 billion in the coming 10 years. So we are responding to the crisis at the same time when looking more optimistically to the future. As I mentioned, we reached to 2,400 attacks of health last week. As of today, it is already 2,504. So, and that means 212 deaths and 768 injured. If we think back since 24th of February, 2022, and Russian Federation invasion, this means more than two attacks every day, more than two attacks every day. That means that healthcare is not the safe place for the patients and healthcare workers, and it's a violation of humanitarian law. In that environment and circumstances, I like to thank all the healthcare workers in Ukraine for all of the efforts that they are doing on saving lives and keeping the health system moving. Now, let me move to the second topic I wanted to cover today, and it's about mental health. In latest health needs assessment WHO has been doing in April 2025, we see that 70% of people reported experiencing mental health issues, anxiety, depression, severe stress over the last 12 months. And this is also directly linked to the attacks on civilian infrastructure that Liz was also just describing. And every second person, 50%, reported significant stress just during the last 2 months, at the time when we see more attacks to the civilian infrastructure. So we see that at the same time, to respond to this challenge, the mental health services are getting more accessible, but not everybody is still seeking it at the level we expect to be seen. What international community, including WHO, has been doing, we have trained since 2022 more than 125,000 healthcare workers on WHO tool MHCAP that is allowing the services to be available more in the primary care. Now the community mental health centers are established and they're expanding, bringing more services available and specialized services available to the communities. And WHO and partners signed just declaration of interest and memorandum yesterday in Kiev to get more partners supporting mental health. And WHO continues to provide trainings in 220 resilience centers that are established by the Minister of Social Policy. Finally, when I look from public resources, Ukraine is prioritizing mental health, as we have been discussing a lot about the mental health program under the leadership of First Lady Olena Zelenska. When we look at public resources that Ukraine is investing to mental health, this has doubled in 2025 compared to the last year. So this is about the attacks and mental health. Let me go to another topic. Ukraine is a big country and we see inequalities which are increasing. We need to reach more to the people who are in the front line, those who are displaced, and rural areas. Let me dwell into the front line as we talk about the humanitarian situation today. less people in the front line have access to the family doctor or have visited the doctor. Only 69% of frontline workers, those people living in the frontline, have visited the primary care doctor, compared to the 74% in the rest of the Ukraine. And this comes because sometimes the doctors are not available, and we are lacking healthcare workers more in the frontline areas. So what WHO has been doing in the past year, since January 2025, or half a year, we have 15 teams working in 82 locations providing primary healthcare. And I'd like to thank all the healthcare workers and doctors working with us. And this has ensured approximately 7,500 consultations. But this is not enough. We need also to arrange convoys because the pharmacies are closed or supplies are not available. So WHO has been part of 25 of interagency convoys organized together with the United Nations and humanitarian partners, and arranged 12 dedicated WHO convoys to the frontline. This is to distribute medicines to people in community, but also trauma kits as the attacks are continuing, and provide medicines for the healthcare workers that they can distribute further for non-communicable diseases. This has allowed to support more than 100,000 people, especially in the frontline. Now, when I look what we do and what all partners are doing in the frontline, this brings me to the fourth topic I wanted to share. It's a financing our humanitarian response. We know about humanitarian reset. We have set the priorities, but we should not leave people behind. And when I look and talk to 119 humanitarian partners who are providing support to the health sector, they are telling me that we not have enough resources. When I look first half of the year, only 35.5% of resources, approximately $46 million, has been made available for humanitarian partners, those 119, to act. This has allowed us collectively, including WHO, to reach to 1 million people. But our target was 3 million, and we should not leave that 2 million behind. So I urge also those who are financing humanitarian response in Ukraine to ensure that we have a humanitarian response funding available, while at the same time we are balancing it with the recovery and restoration. We need to do both at the same time. We have discussed that since the beginning of full-scale invasion. We need to have humanitarian response, but we need to restore and recover, because this will bring back hope to the communities where people are living. Now, this brings me to an end, which is more on lasting impact and recovery. And we need to think collectively how to support Ukraine in the medium term. I told that the recovery needs need $19.4 billion just to restore what is damaged. But Ukrainians have just adopted the Health Strategy 2030. They are looking more eager how to transform the health system further. And this should be supported also by many of us who are in Ukraine. And at the same time, we need to address the challenges which are beyond the humanitarian response. Lately in the public health, we need to be ready for the summer and the heat that many European countries have been going through. The same happens in Odessa or Dnipro or Kharkiv. Second, we need to look to the vaccination levels, especially because we witnessed a number of outbreaks. We have, as a WHO, reviewed 79 outbreaks across the whole Ukraine, and two out of the three outbreaks, meaning 65%, is related to the measles. So we need to ensure catch-up campaigns for the measles. Furthermore, we need to look to the healthy behaviors, because according to our statistics and studies, we see two problems currently. One is heavy drinking among adults, which has been increasing. And the second, novel products of tobacco used by youth. And we need to invest into public health more and health promotion, because this is the human capital of the future Ukraine. And connected to managing alcohol control and tobacco control, we need to invest more to the nutrition particularly to the schools, school nutrition programs. And we should not forget the elderly, those who have left the Ukraine, those who need support on chronic care. So we have witnessed more than two attacks per day in health. We are looking how to ensure support on mental health. We see inequalities are increasing, but that doesn't stop humanitarian and other partners to respond. We are concerned about the humanitarian funding to be sufficient to support people and not to leave people behind. And we should not forget transforming the health system, because this is what Ukraine is envisaging to do, even at the time of war. Thank you. Back to you.
Thank you very much, Jarno, for this comprehensive briefing. I'll open the floor to questions. First in the room, where I see Olivia Reuters.
Thank you very much for this briefing. Just a quick one on the 2,504 attacks on health. So just to check, that includes both attacks on personnel and, you know, medical workers, and also hospitals, medical facilities, etc. So it's across the board. Is that what you meant on that figure? Thank you.
Jarno?
Thank you. Yes, this includes all attacks and of all the type. So they could be attacks on hospitals or primary care. Particularly, we saw many of the primary care facilities attacked last year. It means also healthcare workers. Like in 2024, we saw many of the double tap attacks. Means that when the healthcare workers are going to the site to save lives, there is another attack where, unfortunately, we have lost some of the healthcare workers, and it could be also on the ambulances. So it's all the attacks on health as it is defined. Thank you.
Thank you. Oops, sorry. Thank you very much. If there are no other questions, I'll go to the platform. We have Robin Millard from AFP.
Thank you, Alessandra. Two questions for Liz, if I may. Firstly, will the true toll of civilian deaths and injuries be higher than the figure that you've given that your office is able to verify? And secondly, is there a danger that if there is a move towards a ceasefire, that that justice for the catalogue of gross violations and rights of uses could be overlooked? Thank you.
Thank you, Robin. I think what we have said really for the last sort of 3 years or so is that the verification, the monitoring that we do is according to you know, our methodology. It takes time, and we've always made it clear that the true numbers are likely to be higher. So I think this is almost a given, you know, in a way that our monitoring, our verification lags behind the real number. I mean, just to recap, since February 2022, we have documented the death of at least 13,580 civilians and 34,115 injured. But that's what we have managed to document and verify. So, of course, it's ongoing work that our colleagues in Ukraine do. You make an absolutely key point, because any move towards ceasefire, towards peace, that our accountability must be at its heart. There must be a just peace, there must be accountability for the many violations that have been committed. So that is a central call. I think we've outlined that work on a lasting peace, it has to be in line with international law, and we're setting out that there has to be peace that ensures accountability for gross violations of international human rights law and serious violations of international humanitarian law, which is why, of course, our colleagues in Ukraine are monitoring not only civilian casualties, but also monitoring violations that have been committed with a view, at some point, to ensuring accountability.
Thank you. Lena,
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. So my question is for Liz. First of all, thank you so much for the briefing and for the statistics presented today. However, what struck me a bit with the numbers was the fact that there was not a single mentioning of the Ukrainian drones attacks on the Russian civilian population. Ever since the end of June, the Russian media have extensively reported on such attacks with numerous victims, including in my hometown region of Bryansk, as well as in Kursk, Belgorod, and other parts of the country. So what came as a bit off to me was that the casualties on the Russian side, not one showed up in this briefing, which was not the case before with the previous ones. So my question is whether the OHCHR is aware of these attacks and casualties. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lina. As you may know, that our colleagues do the monitoring for civilian casualties in Ukraine, but they are also aware of reported casualties that are in the Russian Federation, and you have highlighted some of the regions where you know there are reports that this has been happening. The latest report that we published on the human rights situation in Ukraine, it covered the period from the 31st of December 2024 to the 31st of May 2025. And it had a part where it referred to the civilian casualties in the Russian Federation. And if I may, I'll just highlight this, that in that time period, the Russian authorities reported that 99 civilians were killed and 648 injured in attacks launched by the Ukrainian armed forces in 11 regions of the Russian Federation. Now, work is ongoing, but the UN Human Rights Office has established some information regarding these. However, and this is important to stress, the circumstances of many of the incidents remain subject to verification due to the lack of access to the Russian Federation and limited publicly available information. As you again may know, we have repeatedly asked for access to the Russian Federation. So it's not a case of us not reporting on it. It's not a case of us not being aware of it. It's just that the different circumstances. But I think that the key point here, and it's worth repeating, is intense and sustained attacks using explosive weapons with wide area effects in populated areas, and this is a general point, doesn't matter which country, in populated areas are likely to have indiscriminate impacts and as such raise serious concerns as to their compliance with international humanitarian law. So that is a general principle and one that we will repeat no matter what the country, no matter what the circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this information. Liz, is there any other question on Ukraine? I don't see any other hand up. So thank you very much, Liz, and thanks to Jarno from Kyiv for this briefing of this update on the situation of Ukraine. On my part, I have only one announcement to make. And it's about the Human Rights Committee that tomorrow at 10 a.m. Will hold a public meeting to review the concluding observation and state reports of this session. On Thursday at 4 p.m., the committee will conclude the session and issue the concluding observation on the seven countries that they reviewed, which were Kazakhstan, Guinea-Bissau, North Macedonia, Latvia, Spain, Haiti, and Vietnam. And on the 28th of July, the official beginning of the third and last part of the 2025 session of the Conference on Disarmament will begin under the presidency of Malaysia, which will be followed then by Mexico from the 18th of August to the 12th of September. These are the few announcements I had. If there are no further questions and I see no hands up, I'd like to thank you all very much for following this briefing and see you on Friday. Thanks.